Hi, my name is Andrea Merriam. I'm 41 years old. I'm in Chandler, Arizona right now. I'm currently the acting CEO of the Parkinson and Movement Disorder Alliance, a nonprofit where I've been so pleased to know Dr. Neil Hermanowitz as a physician advisor of ours.
And I'm Neil Hermanowitz. I am 68 years old. I am at the moment in El Paso, Texas, but I work in Santa Fe, New Mexico for now. Next month I'll be relocating back to California, where I've spent the majority of my career, Southern California. I will be in Rancho Mirage, California. For those of you who are not familiar with Southern California, that's pretty much the same place as Palm Springs, California. So I'm a physician, and I've been working in the field of movement disorders, and especially Parkinson's disease, since I finished my fellowship at the University of Michigan in 1991, a long time ago.
And I don't know if you remember this, Dr. Hermanowitz, but I know the first time I met you was I read your bio as you were about to enter a speaking engagement, step up to the podium, and I was just so impressed that it was a very hefty CV of many accomplishments. And then when you addressed the crowd, it was just so human, and you talked about how you were from a town called Normal, and it was an interesting juxtaposition of this this medical career with just a kind human being.
Well, I grew up in Normal, Illinois. That's correct, and it gets even better because I lived on Normal Avenue in Normal, Illinois, and I did not go to the Normal Community High School. I went to a different one, but there was a Normal Community High School. I did go to the Normal Public Library. I saw movies at the Normal Theater. So yeah, I grew up in the Midwest in Central Illinois, and have not actually lived there for a long time, but that makes an impression.
It sure does. And what does that say about the urban planners of Illinois to really just double, triple, quadruple down on the Normal concept?
Well, I'll tell you where it came from. The Normal, Illinois got its name from what was then Illinois Normal College, which was a teacher's college. And teachers' colleges were called normal colleges. And then later, Illinois Normal College became Illinois State University. They dropped the normal, and the town was already stuck with the name. I don't know why they did that, but they did. And so Normal has been Normal ever since.
I did not know that about teacher colleges.
Yeah.
I am the child of two school teachers,
Right.
both my mom and father taught school. My dad taught high school, and my mom taught a little bit of everything. And I don't think that I would associate Normal with the teaching and educational career. So interesting.
Yeah, I don't know the background of that. My father was also a teacher, for he taught math in junior high initially, and then he later became a professor of education. Where did you grow up? I don't think I know.
I grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, so
Okay,
the
all right.
DC metro area.
Okay, I've been there. Yep.
Yes, and after going to college in very cold Boston, I headed for the warmth, and I definitely maybe overshot the mark because Phoenix, Arizona, we got sun, we have warmth in spades.
So Boston, where were you in Boston? Because I spent a little time there.
I went to Boston University, and
Okay.
then after graduating, I lived in lovely Allston, Massachusetts.
Okay. So yeah, when I went to the University of Illinois for college, and then when I went initially, I thought I'm going to become a doctor. I'm going to be a pre-med, and declared myself as such. And then along the way, I got distracted. I like chemistry and I like physics. And I thought, oh, I think I'll be a scientist. And I went to graduate school, and I went to graduate school actually in Cambridge, right across the river from where you were. I was at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and it took me about 3 or 4 days to realize what a stupid mistake I made. I stuck it out for a year, but it was like, you know, going to jail every day. They were wonderful. It was a great school. Everybody knows that. And they were very nice to me. And I remember one morning I woke up and I walked and I just said, I can't do this. I walked with a very heavy heart to my advisor's office, who happened to be then the chair of the chemistry department. I said, I'm so sorry, but I just can't find my way to loving this. And he said, you know, I understand. It's not for everybody. And I stopped after a year and took some biology classes. My parents had then moved from Central, had left Normal, and had moved to Central Pennsylvania, which was a convenient stopping place for me, where I took some biochemistry and genetics and did apply to medical school. And along that way, met a woman named Dagny Thorgilsdottir, who is still my wife. So it turned out okay.
And so, where along the way did medicine turn into neurology and movement disorders?
You know, before I went to medical school, I was already interested in the brain. I thought, this is so fascinating. I would read things like Scientific American would have articles about the brain. And I thought, this is really gets my attention. This somehow resonates with me. And exactly why, I'm not sure. It just seemed, you know, the brain, the central computer for everything, for movement, for mood, for memory, for so many things. It just seems so fascinating. And I had pretty much decided before I went to medical school that I was going to be a brain doctor in some fashion. I didn't really know anything about being a neurologist or what neurology meant or what they did. I thought, well, maybe it's psychiatry because I knew they had something to do with the brain. But it became quickly apparent to me in medical school that neurology was more along the lines of my interest than psychiatry. Although neurology and psychiatry are close cousins, they, you know, share a lot of the same topics, patients.
Yes. And it's interesting knowing you now. You know, I maybe have some hindsight, but I've always admired your ability to speak with people and tease out and, you know, get them to surface you know, their experience. And was that always, I would think that you know, neurology, the brain, behavior, you know, the center of it all, that unlike maybe some types of medicine where it's very based in imaging, or you know, there are just the role of that patient interaction is a lot different. Was that any of the pull?
No. Not really initially. I think that I sometimes, not often, but occasionally reflected on that sort of thing. And I was just communicating with a friend recently about my interest in medicine. And the brain is fascinating and the science is fascinating. But I think what really drew me to a career in medicine instead of physical chemistry, which is what I was studying at MIT, was I like the people connection. And I think it's just because I'm nosy, or I like to learn about people. And I don't know that my personality outside of my work is gregarious. I would say no. But I enjoy meeting people and I enjoy learning their life stories. We often find some commonality. Not most people have lived in Normal, Illinois, but it's interesting to learn about people's paths and how it has an impact on their present and how they view themselves, and also has an impact on how they cope with chronic illness, I think, or how they respond to the burden of living with a chronic illness. So I think that's important to know. And I like to know that. I find it interesting. I like their life stories.
You say nosy, I hear curious, and I see that echoed in myself. I just always, you know, have a question to ask, and then to apply it back to, you know, your study of neurology, all of your clinical experience. I think that that's an added dimension to ask questions and find out about people, but then to apply back.
So I didn't ask you, what did you study at Boston University?
I studied philosophy.
There you go.
Yeah, I bounced around a lot. And then, see, I had some very supportive parents who, you know, understood that, yes, university wasn't necessarily an investment to get in, you know, return on investment. But yes, they are lovers of information. So
well, I do feel. I get that. And I'll tell you, when I met my wife in State College, Pennsylvania, that little town in the middle of Pennsylvania, middle of nowhere, it has a big football stadium and a large university, but not much else around there. She was a graduate student in philosophy.
Ooh.
And my daughter, I have two children. When my daughter went to college at UCLA, I said, you know, study, this is an opportunity to expand your horizons and grow and learn new things and so forth. And, you know, follow wherever your heart leads you, but philosophy may not be the right direction. What do you do with that? And of course, she got a degree like her mother in philosophy.
Then there we go. See, look, you said that you find commonalities and connections to people, and you just did. And it's only 10 minutes in.
Yeah, but she's not a philosopher currently. She did pursue that, loved it. I think it brought great things to her breadth of knowledge, even though she's not a philosophy professor or writing philosophy papers now. I think it has served her very well in her unfolding career.
Yes. And I consider my career still unfolding. And
me
I
too.
Think as, you know, in my work with PMD Alliance, you know, a lot of what we do is listen and ask questions and find out what do people need, where are their gaps, what does their journey look like, what resources do they need. And having, you know, philosophy as it's, I consider it very foundational, way, way back in my past, but it's been a solid foundation. So I'm glad.
It is a foundation, and it does serve people well as they move through whatever career they find themselves in later in life. I think that's a good place to start.
Yes. And in our work together, in my role at PMD Alliance, you know, understanding the needs of people with movement disorders, you know, creating resources, creating opportunities, it has always been a just so insightful and lovely to work with you on sharing the, you know, from the clinical side of things, you know, what you see need, you know, what you see people needing. Do they have a hard time? A good place to start would be, you know, do they have a hard time communicating what they need with their physician or with their clinician? And maybe we can talk about that. When you meet with a patient and their family member, or I don't know if that's an always or a sometimes,
always.
But how do you, so many clinicians have a hard time, you know, peeling back those layers and finding out what is really going on. And so many people, they just want to talk about, you know, the surface symptoms and how do you, you know, build a relationship, like actually find out what's happening?
Well, one, we have to get to know each other. The person I'm seeing it as a clinician, as a physician, and I, we need to get to know each other. And I'll tell you, I made a mistake earlier in my career. I was not the same doctor when I first finished my training. In many ways, and we can talk about that later. But I was a bit more, I think, remote. People say, do you have children? I would say, well, we're not really here to talk about me. Let's talk about you. And I realized they were wanting to establish a connection. Later, I realized that. The first few years, maybe I didn't realize that. But when they ask me questions like that, they want to know who I am, and just to, you know, I want to know who they are. So I let my nosiness blossom, my curiosity, I guess. I would release that and was not so withholding of personal information about myself. Now, I don't necessarily, you know, share everything, but yeah, I tell people I got two kids and what they're doing, and you know, my, you know, fragments of at least my life story. And I think that allows us to have a connection to talk about what's important to them. I get to know them, they get to know me. And I think that works better than sort of the, you know, the guy behind the mask, you know, what are your, how's the tremor, how's the stiffness, how are you moving kind of thing. So I think that it was a lesson I needed to learn. And I did in my first job. And I saw a lot of patients, and I got so much better, I think, at communicating and allowing people to communicate with me and tell me what they were looking for and what they needed. And I think I'm, you know, still make mistakes along the way. Who doesn't? But I've really enjoyed my work so much more after I sort of let that guard or that mask down and got to know people and let them know, get to know me. It makes it better. I enjoy that so much more. It's not just a factory line of seeing patient after patient after patient. And I worked in the factory in the past, and I know what that's like. A couple of times I did that. So, and I think it's better for patients to have, here's a guy who seems to understand me. We can talk, we can chat, and I kind of know him, and he sort of knows me. I think it works better that way.
Is there a flip side to that connection? That, you know, with Parkinson's being, you know, a lot of the patients that you see, and it being a degenerative disease,
yep.
How do you cope with that?
Well, that's the bad side of being in what I do, in what we, I guess, and you as well, the PMD Alliance as well. That's the downside, is that people sometimes have more difficulty as time goes by, and sometimes people die. And nobody likes that. That's bad.
It is something that I do deal with as well. And I think something that working with people with chronic illness just has taught me and continues to inspire me is, you know, we all have limited time, but perhaps when you have a chronic illness, you know, your limited time on earth is just that much more evident. So I don't know, I think the people that we work with, I'm so inspired. So many of them are just so in the moment and mindful and, you know, experiencing joy when they have it. And so I look to that side of the connections.
Yeah, I think one wants to make the here and now as meaningful as possible and not dwell. I mean, people ask me in my work, not infrequently, how long will I live with this diagnosis? And, you know, the answer is, I don't know. More commonly, perhaps they ask me, what's going to happen to me as time goes by? And I don't know that either. I can't predict. And every once in a while, I run into a patient where a doctor, they say, I don't know, I wasn't there, but the doctor will say, well, you've got five good years. And after that, things are going to kind of, the wheels are going to come off. And I think, what the heck are they talking about? How could they, well, you know, this person must be a time traveler or something, that they have that kind of information. Because I've been doing this 30 some years, and I don't know those answers. I mean, I know the answer. We're all going to die, right? Everybody in the room, we're all going to die. So that I can tell them with some certainty, but in terms of how they will be. And also, it's a changing game, right? I mean, fortunately, it's a changing game because when I started doing this, when I finished my residency in 1989, there weren't a lot of people, meaning pharmaceutical companies, that were interested in Parkinson's. Now there's a whole slew of them, and you can, you know, everybody wants to throw stones at the pharmaceutical companies, but for crying out loud, they're the people who bring stuff, new stuff. You know, I worked at university most of my career, and there's no new therapy that ever came out of a university that I'm aware of. The ideas can come out of university. Arvid Carlson, who dopamine and Parkinson's, he's got the Nobel Prize. was a professor. But the bringing of those ideas to my patients is done by pharmaceutical companies, which fortunately, there are lots of them that have an interest now in Parkinson's disease. So it's a changing game. It is changing more rapidly than it was, I would say, in the first several years of my career. There are therapies directed toward, you know, getting after the disease, not just trying to alleviate symptoms. And it'd be great to have both.
Yeah. So with your, you know, long clinical career, you said 30 years.
Yeah, about
so
that.
In the beginning, when there were fewer medication options, did it affect the way that you practice as, you know, new medications came on the market?
Yes. So there are more options. It made it, you know, the options when I started and finished my residency in 1989 and fellowship in 91, the options were levodopa. There was a dopamine agonist at that time called bromocriptine, or Parlodel is the other name for it, which almost nobody used. And things have, more tools have come along the way. They have not exceeded in terms of addressing some of the motor symptoms. They've not really been better than what we had since 1975, levodopa, carbidopa, levodopa. But there are modifications. You know, people have been, well, levodopa, that was a big deal, as I just said. Arvid Carlson got the Nobel Prize in 2000 for his work in dopamine, which led to the arrival of levodopa, which was a major deal. I mean, it's sort of ho-hum now, but when that came to pass, it was game-changing in a way that I don't think can be appreciated now. But yeah, as more options became available, it became a little bit more complex, I think, for everybody which medication is correct. And I think that's why treating Parkinson's disease, it really is enabled more if you have some training in that area. Not everybody can do that, and also some experience. So you can do some damage with these medications if you're not careful. It's kind of hard to keep track of what are the side effects of everything, and what medication is best, a better fit for a certain patient. But yeah, it's been encouraging that more companies have come on the scene. I'm waiting for the next big thing, the next big levodopa. And there are some very interesting things that are being looked at right now.
Yeah. And if I could ask one more question about that, you know, that long spanning clinical practice, have you seen generational shifts? Like when you were first practicing, was it, from the greatest generation to baby boomers, and maybe now, I guess you're probably still, you know, diagnosing, and most of your patients are baby boomers, but I've just always been curious in, you know, just how different generations, maybe earlier in your career, was there, you know, more of the just grin and bear it, stiff upper lip, let's just, you know, power through, and are people being more communicative? Or I don't know, that was me just making it up, but have you seen generational shifts?
Huge change, but it's not really generational, it's informational. Because when I started my practice, there was no internet, and it was word of mouth at support groups, which did exist prior to the internet. And now there's the internet, which is both good and bad. So people are learning things that they would not otherwise read. Sometimes what they read is good, and sometimes it's crazy nonsense. I remember years ago in my first job, a long time ago, when I think it was just the dawn of the internet, and an elderly woman who I was seeing, I remember quite well, she was very nice. She was German, a thick German accent. And she came into her appointment one day, and she said, what's all this about superoxide dismutase? She was reading about some enzyme that was being studied in its relationship to the pathology of Parkinson's disease. So that was a huge change in people becoming self-informed in good and sometimes not so good ways, both. So that's been a change, but I don't think that's You know, the younger people are more likely to be using all sorts of technologies, I suppose, and have more rapid access. But almost everybody I see has got a computer and has had one for a long time. Mm-hmm. Internet.
And as maybe I should hesitate to ask this question, because, right, you're not supposed to ask a question you don't know the answer to. But as someone in the, you know, so PMD Alliance, we do provide information to people, maybe are part of that that information, you know, definitely on the internet and trying to be a source to people who want to find out about the symptoms of the disease, the treatment options. We like to focus on what they can do, you know, how they can connect with each other, how you can find a support group or an exercise group, you know, in your own town. But for someone, you know, for someone in the, I'll categorize myself in the, you know, information business, what is there anything that, any, I don't know, words or advice that you want to share, having then the information that maybe people like me give your patients, then they bring it to your, you know, that doctor's visit. So just, I don't know if that's interesting.
No, well, I have 3 points along this line. So I get the emails from the PMD Alliance and the speakers and the programs and so forth. And I have to say, by and large, I'm so impressed. I mean, I saw just recently, yesterday, the day before, Ray Dorsey, who I happen to know, originally from Southern California. He's at the University of Rochester. He was a pioneer in telehealth, telemedicine for Parkinson's disease. And he and Mike Okun and a third person wrote a book about the end of Parkinson's disease, which I've read. And actually, Ray sent me a copy, but I'd read it before he sent it. Thanks, Ray. Nonetheless, you know, Ray's a big thinker. And I've seen other an important person, a nice guy in addition. If you've not met him, you'd like him. So I'm so impressed by some of the names I recognize, the people I know that are providing these programs through the organization. So that's fantastic. So that also provides a filter in a way, you know, the people that you're having speak, I think, are unlikely to be advocates of witchcraft or other things that are not likely, you know, not likely to help and could actually cause some harm to people. So that's one good thing that your organization does. The other thing, and I'm not sure everybody who works there at PMD Alliance understands it, I think they probably do, the importance of social connection, which has been devastating during this pandemic. There's a whole field, which I've come to appreciate even more so, about so-called social neuroscience, and how our socialization directly affects our health in so many ways. And there was a paper some years ago, I think it mostly came out of the UK, but there's some American authors too, about how loneliness was the greatest threat to health, the public's health of elderly people. Now, not everybody who's alone is lonely, but people who are lacking a sense of social connection, that has potentially devastating effects. Heart function, brain function, general health. It's, you know, there's some validity to being these names that we've used over the years. I'm homesick, I'm heart sick. This disconnection from our social network that sustains us all. And it's already tough. If somebody's got Parkinson's, you know, they may be less likely to go out or less, maybe they're more a bit more reluctant to mix with friends and that sort of thing. It's harder to get out and about for some people. And that has bad effects on all of us, and even I think more so in somebody who's struggling with a chronic illness like Parkinson's disease. So PMD Alliance has done a world of good in encouraging those connections, especially during the pandemic, by providing online support groups and so forth, which I'm aware you guys have been doing. That's been hugely beneficial. I think it's, you know, when I went through medical school and residency and fellowship, it was really focusing on the hard science, and nobody ever brought up this stuff about it hurts us, it not just, it hurts us emotionally, it hurts us physically to be lonely and be disconnected and not have that human connection. That's not good. Everybody talks about exercise. Yes, yes, yes. And that's good. And I get it. I do too. And I think that's another important progression in the treatment of Parkinson's disease. But nobody's really emphasizing this business about how it is really important that people not stay at home in a corner in a chair watching television. They need to be connected to people. You know, as you are probably aware, the PMD Alliance, along with some of us, did a survey about how the pandemic was affecting people. And as you would predict, people with Parkinson's disease and asthma would predict, it affects them badly. And that's going to be presented actually at a meeting in Orlando as a platform presentation. The American Association of Geriatric Psychiatry is the meeting, and I'm going to be delivering that if I can get the Zoom connection right. Fortunately, I don't need to go to Orlando to do it. I can do it by Zoom. But it's also been accepted for publication in a journal, and it's just reinforcing this idea. I mean, the novelty is that we looked at people with Parkinson's disease, but it reinforces this idea that, my gosh, we all need to have that human connection. And maybe even more so for people who are struggling, you know, get that burden on their shoulders of dealing with Parkinson's disease.
Absolutely. It's something that is core to what we do, that community is a nutrient. You know, humans are social animals. We need other people. And I'd like to think that if there is something that the pandemic has, you know, allowed us to learn and, you know, reflect on, is that, you know, all of us experienced, you know, that isolation and loneliness. And hopefully we will be more empathetic and, you know, recognize that it does matter and it affects, yeah, mental health, but physical health. So I couldn't agree more with everything that you said. And I think the paper that you mentioned, the survey that we worked on together, is one way that some of these, because I talked to my mom about, you know, this work, and she's like, of course people need other people. Why do you need to survey 500 people and write an academic paper and publish it? But sometimes, you know, in the field that we are in, it, you know, takes a, you have to present information in a certain way. So I'm glad that we're working that together.
I'm going to call your mother and tell her exactly why, because people who do what I do don't necessarily appreciate that. We all have limited time. Patient appointments, unfortunately, have just gotten shorter over the years. And so time is limited, but that this has actually been neglected, in my opinion. It's been neglected in training of medical students and residents and fellows, the importance of this. So the exercise component, I think that's entered everybody's thinking about Parkinson's disease, but this so-called social neuroscience, which is a valid, it was initiated by a guy who's now deceased, unfortunately, largely at the University of Chicago. But there are scientific papers analyzing what happens to heart function. People who are likely to get a heart attack, they're more likely to have dementia, they're more likely to die. People who are deprived of their social connections that are, in fact, lonely. And you're right. I mean, you put it very well, that the social connection is a nutrient. It is something that we have undervalued in medicine, at least from my experience, for far too long. It really should be entering part of medical student training and training of other clinicians. Mm-hmm. So tell your mother.
Okay. I'm going to tell her to listen to this StoryCorps interview.
That's right.
Well, in our last few minutes here, I think we have time for one more question. Let's see. We have a lot of big, weighty questions that we could go to, like, what do you want to be known for, or what do you want to change, or what are your dreams for the future of the Parkinson's community? I don't know, any big, bow on it questions that we should go to, Dr. Manowitz? It's been a lovely time kind of meandering and talking through and chit-chatting with you.
As with everybody, I want this disease to go away. I don't know if that's going to happen. I mean, people have been holding out that promise throughout my career. I've been hearing that, five more years we'll have a cure. And I don't know this to be true. But I want this disease to go away. And I think that it will be done by trying largely by identifying people who are likely to get it. They may not have it quite yet. It's not quite evident as a movement disorder. It might be evident as a GI disorder or as a sleep disorder. There are clues that people may be developing Parkinson's disease. And I think that's where there is focus on that. So we've done this with mammography. We do it with colonoscopies. We find polyps and clip them before they become a problem. We find lumps in a breast and remove them before they become metastatic breast cancer. So the idea of this, of preventative neurology, is, I think, a valid one. We're not there yet, but that's what I hope that we can do, is stop it before it becomes, find the people who are maybe heading down that path and stop it before it becomes such a problem. And meanwhile, I hope that the therapies that we have just get better and better. I mean, people have asked me in the past, and I don't want to take up too much time, that why did I go into this field in movement disorders? I thought initially I might go into epilepsy. I told you I studied physics and chemistry, and there's a lot of physics and chemistry in epilepsy and the assessment of seizures and how membranes work and in the brain and so forth. But and in my work, everywhere I've worked, and I've worked in a few places now, and in Santa Fe, I've been seeing general neurology, including epilepsy and multiple sclerosis, and I like my patients in general. But there's something I find drawing to the movement disorders community. The people are nice. They really are. Not all doctors are nice, right? But they are a nice group of people, and I want nice things for these nice people to happen. I don't want I want better treatments, and I want better outcomes.
Absolutely. And a support group leader that we work with, her name is Cindy Bitker. She has a beautiful line, so I will quote her. She says, "Until there's a cure, there's community." And that's something that, while yes, the researchers and the clinical trials and on your side of things, yes, I hope that there are breakthroughs, but until then, there's a lot to be said. And it, you said it yourself, there's a lot to be said for building a community, having a social network, finding friendships, and helps a lot to cope with, whether it's Parkinson's disease, another chronic illness, or all of us need that.
And I have to say, hats off to the PMD Alliance. I've been in the game, the work that I've been doing for quite some time, and I don't think I've encountered another organization that has been so committed to community and follows through with their commitments as the PMD Alliance does. Really, I'm so impressed. And I have been, I was initially wary, as I have some of the other groups that I've interacted with over the years. What's their agenda? What's going on here? And the agenda here seems to be the people themselves, the patients, and their care partners, as we say. And that seems to be the only agenda that I've uncovered. So thank Absolutely. You very much.
Well, appreciate thank it. You. We should just stop right now on that note. But it's been lovely to talk to you. Thank you for everything you do for not just your patients and their families, but you are a thought leader and, have been so impactful to the movement disorder community. So thank you.
Well, thank you.